Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get started, I want to share an update. It is one of my favorite times of the year here at The World, time to connect with you in our annual fall fundraiser. You probably already know that it is a whole team of amazing people who put The World together every day. The news you hear relies on correspondents and editors, producers, and engineers. What you may not know is that none of this would be possible without financial support from listeners. The World is built on a nonprofit newsroom. That means we can bring you the news every day without compromise. We can focus on bringing you voices that you won't hear anywhere else, but only when listeners like you donate to keep the show going. So here's where you come in. Our goal is to raise $67,000 between now and Giving Tuesday on November 30th. When we hit the goal, a generous donor will match every gift, dollar for dollar. It's just a matter of your support. We're looking for 515 listeners to give $130 right now or to pledge a gift of $10.83 each month for a year. If 515 people come through by November 30th, we can secure this match. Every gift will help us get closer to our goal. I hope you'll support our newsroom and give today. You can donate right now at theworld.org/give or visit theworld.org to learn more. Thank you, and now on to the show.
Support comes from Redefiners, a new podcast from Russell Reynolds Associates. If you want to lead boldly, then Redefiners, a new podcast, is a must listen. Join hosts Nanez Motashami and Clark Murphy as they engage in purposeful conversations with leaders in and out of business, each sharing their insights and perspectives with you. Every episode gives you tangible takeaways and fresh ideas to help you redefine your own leadership trajectory, no matter where you are in your journey. Listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
Two months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, a deep trip into the countryside shows the level of dysfunction.
All the bridges along the road, all the way from Kandahar, were destroyed, like blown to pieces.
Also today, as world leaders in Glasgow discuss the big climate solutions, we look at what you and I can do when we're shopping for groceries.
People want to understand what they're really eating, and they want to understand, is the stuff I'm buying off the shelf in the supermarket, like, should I feel guilty about this? Like, is it sustainable?
A new push to inform customers on the environmental impacts of our food. I'm Marco Werman, and Haitians deported from the U.S. arrive back home with determination.
The moment they return, they think where to go next, or try another country, or go back where they come from.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us today. It has been less than 2 months since thousands of Haitians were encamped under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, at the U.S.-Mexico border. Some were let into the U.S., most were deported to Haiti, but many of them had been living away from their native country for years. The World's Monica Campbell traveled to Haiti and spoke with deportees about their new reality.
Desacia and Diani are two young women in shock. They can't do this, Diani says in Spanish. We left Haiti years ago, and now we're back. We're at the airport in Port-au-Prince, Haiti's capital, and we're speaking in Spanish because Desacia and Diani lived in Chile for about 4 years before deciding to migrate to the U.S. in September. At the border, they were taken into custody and held in a detention facility for weeks before being put on a deportation flight. Now, Desacia and Diani are standing in a makeshift reception area near the tarmac. There's tents with white tarps and folding chairs in neat rows. The women managed to borrow a stranger's phone.
Hello, Jean-Claude. Yes.
Diani calls her brother who lives in Haiti for help. They ask not to use their full names because they plan on trying to enter the U.S. again. They say they left Haiti when they were 15. They're 19 now. The Biden administration says it had to move fast to deport the large number of Haitians who arrived at the border in September to deter more from coming. It's also continuing a pandemic-era health order called Title 42 that lets border officials automatically turn away migrants and asylum seekers, no questions asked. But Diani has lots of questions for the U.S. Tell me, she asks, is there even a president in Haiti? She's referring to Haiti's president, who was assassinated in July. No, she says there's no president. So how can I be sent back to a country where they can murder the president? As the women make calls, another deported woman breastfeeds a baby girl while holding a small boy's hand. Haitian police stand watch with long rifles. Then a man arrives with a cart filled with white sacks, people's belongings. Desacia and Diani grab their bags and pour out what they carried. Some clothing, a Bible, a hairbrush, and some perfumed body spray. Meanwhile, the Boeing 737 that brought them here lifts off overhead.
And now they're back to Haiti with nothing.
Giuseppe Loprete is the mission chief for the UN's migration agency in Haiti. He spent long days at the airport assisting migrants and offering what he can.
Some cash, some hygiene kits, and something to sort out at least for the first few days, maybe a couple of weeks.
The U.S. State Department has funded part of that help. Loprete says many Haitians arrive back completely disoriented and focused on how soon they can leave again.
The moment they return, they think where to go next, or try another country, or go back where they come from.
That's the goal for Esther Toma. She was deported about a month ago from the Texas border with her 11-year-old daughter. They also migrated first to Chile, which once allowed Haitians to enter with ease. Toma got by as a housekeeper until Chile's policies changed, and there was a rumor that the Biden administration was allowing all families into the U.S. In Texas, she saw Border Patrol agents on horseback chasing off Haitians. How could this happen, she asks, especially, she says, with Haiti's big rise in violence and a massive earthquake in August. She only sees racism. It's like having black skin is a sin, she says. Now, in Haiti, Tomas shows me this small cinder block basement apartment where she and her daughter live. This is the living room. 10 people in total live here. All but 2 have been deported from the U.S. In the kitchen, Toma opens the fridge.
So the refrigerator doesn't have electricity.
She points to a flashlight on the table.
No hay luz, no hay nada, no hay seguridad.
There's no electricity and it's not safe here. She says she needs to figure out a plan to leave, but she can't ask her relatives in the U.S. to help fund another journey. She also tells me what happened while she and her daughter trekked the thousands of miles from Chile to the U.S. border. In Honduras, they paid $250 to get smuggled into Guatemala in a truck trailer. She thought they'd be in that cramped space for about 10 minutes. It was 3 hours, she says. There was hardly any air. We nearly died. This is common. Just this week, 54 Haitians, including kids, were detained in Guatemala after being found in a trailer. Still, Tomas says she'd be willing to risk it again. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Later this week, Monica reports from Haiti on people planning a different way to get to the U.S. by boat. Follow more of our reporting on several crises gripping Haiti right now. That's online at theworld.org. Let's check in with the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, COP26. COP stands for Conference of the Parties. After setting a tone of urgency and sweeping speeches, world leaders have now left Scotland and handed business over to their negotiators. They'll roll up their sleeves and do the nitty-gritty work for the next week and a half. But will they turn promises into reality?
I'm cautiously optimistic that we are making progress.
COP26 President Alok Sharma spoke today. One of the biggest sticking points for the nearly 200 countries gathered in Glasgow is going to be money, delivering on a promise of $100 billion to help vulnerable nations deal with the impacts of climate change.
It is about making sure that countries are supported to shift to clean energy and that no one is left behind as we consign coal to the history books.
Countries and institutions today did announce pledges of billions of dollars for climate finance. UN envoy and former Bank of England governor Mark Carney also made a related announcement. He said some $130 trillion of assets are now managed by financial institutions committed to net zero emissions by mid-century.
These are the best in finance that are committed to making the transition to net zero a reality. Over 450 major financial institutions from 45 countries are committing to manage their balance sheets in line with net zero.
But Carney's words do not mean banks will stop funding new oil, gas, or coal projects anytime soon, something the International Energy Agency says needs to happen immediately to meet climate targets. Meanwhile, at the conference, long lines to get in, COVID capacity restrictions, and technical problems have been limiting access for activists and observers who want to be there. Some 40,000 people are registered to attend the event, but capacity at the space is only for 10,000. The UN official overseeing the meeting, Patricia Espinoza, asked attendees to bear with us.
I personally am surprised at the enthusiasm and the amount of people that have come to Glasgow. And I feel this is fantastic, but it does pose a significant challenge in terms of logistics.
The UN apologized for the challenges yesterday. They pointed to COVID and the unprecedented logistical circumstances of holding the huge meeting during a pandemic. There is a lot of information on food packaging, ingredients, nutritional data, sell-by date. Now, an increasing number of companies is looking to add another piece of information, eco-scores, to tell you how environmentally friendly or harmful your food is. The world's Bianca Hillier has the details.
A Northern Ireland company called MashDirect is one of the first to put eco-scores on its products. It grows and sells vegetable side dishes, potatoes, carrots, turnips, that kind of thing. CEO Jack Hamilton is the sixth generation to lead the family farm.
People want to understand what they're really eating, and they want to understand, is the stuff I'm buying off the shelf in the supermarket, like, should I feel guilty about this? Like, is it sustainable?
To start the grading process, Hamilton's team went through the life cycle of each product and analyzed precisely how the food is grown, transported, packaged, and sold. They then sent all of that data to Foundation Earth, a nonprofit working to bring eco-labels to the UK and the EU. Their sustainability advisors grade each product on carbon emissions, water usage, water pollution, and biodiversity loss. Hamilton says he wasn't sure how well his food would do.
So we were kind of just like fingers crossed. We were hoping to get a few decent grades out of it.
They ended up getting pretty high marks. All of the products they had rated got A's, except one, which got a B. It's called Colcannon, a traditional Irish dish of mashed potatoes with cabbage and onions. Hamilton wanted to know why it got a lower grade and soon realized.
Onions are one of the few things we don't grow ourselves. And our onion supplier at times a year was sourcing their onions from Spain. And then we were able to call the grower in Spain and ask them. And then they said, well, actually, we're getting some of ours in from Peru.
The onion's long journey was news to Hamilton. But it wasn't carbon emissions that dragged down its score the most. It was how much water was used to produce it. So Hamilton looked for a fix.
We got on the phone, found an onion grower who's like 3 hours down the road from us, and we were able to switch.
Hamilton would like to see more companies get their products audited. Right now, just a handful across the UK and the EU are testing out eco scores. France is piloting its own system with mixed results. Of nearly 300,000 food products graded, 68% received a C or worse. But just figuring out those grades is tricky.
It's a very difficult thing to do.
Jean-Pierre Schweitzer is a policy officer at the European Environmental Bureau. He says calculating these scores can be really complicated, especially when companies don't have much control over their supply chain. Estimated data could lead to inaccurate grades. Schweitzer also says eco scores are only one way to lower agriculture's environmental impact.
It's also about regulations on the agricultural production, making sure that certain types of pesticides are no longer allowed, supporting pollinators, things like that.
What's more, conflating all of a product's environmental impacts into one score sometimes doesn't tell the whole story. For example, one company's almonds received an F in water usage, but an A+ in carbon emissions. The final grade ended up as a B. Despite an imperfect system, one study suggests that consumers are willing to fold this information into their decisions at the store. Brian Cook, a senior researcher at the University of Oxford, carried out the experiment.
We have a virtual online supermarket, so it's got fake food and fake money.
During the pandemic, participants were asked to use that fake money to buy supermarket items. Some had eco labels, some did not. Cook says they chose to go green.
And most people do end up selecting a shopping basket that has a lower environmental impact compared to if you have no labels.
In the real world, though, results are still pending. Mash Direct from Northern Ireland has only used EcoScores since September. CEO Jack Hamilton says they don't have enough information yet to draw any conclusions, but he's confident the scores can shift consumer behavior. It's already shifted how things work on the farm.
I'm generation number 6. We need to think about generation 7, 8 and what the farm's going to look like for them.
After going through the EcoScore process, he feels better equipped to head in the right direction. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Tomorrow marks 1 year since the fighting began in the northern Ethiopian region of Tigray, between Tigrayan militias and the Ethiopian National Army, dragging in other armed groups as well. Now we're getting a clearer picture of what's been happening in the north, and it is grim. A joint investigation was just released by United Nations human rights officials and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. It found that all sides in the civil war are guilty of committing widespread human rights abuses. This comes at a moment when the fighting has expanded. That's threatening stability across Ethiopia and the region. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi is on the line with me now. Halima, what have we learned today from this new report?
Well, Marco, it really confirms a lot of what we knew already, that horrible, horrible human rights violations have been committed by all parties in this conflict, including the Ethiopian military, forces from neighboring Eritrea, Tigrayan special forces, and forces from various ethnic militias. Marcel Akpovo is a representative of the UN Human Rights Office, which co-authored the report, and here's some of what he had to say today.
And the joint investigation team uncover numerous violation and an abuse, including unlawful killings, extrajudicial execution, torture, sexual and gender-based violence, violation against refugee, and then forced displacement of civilians.
And he shared some specific examples of families being killed by shelling, of civilians hacked to death by ethnic militias. So really terrible things that really brings home the gravity of the human toll of this conflict in the past year.
What has been the response from the Ethiopian government?
Well, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said that the report dispelled false accusations against his government, including accusations about genocide and the blocking of humanitarian aid. But actually, that wasn't the mandate or mission of this report. The purpose of it was to serve as a fact-finding mission during a time where facts have really been elusive, and also to record abuses and put them on the record. No party of this conflict comes out clean, including the Ethiopian government. Daniel Bekele heads the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, which worked with the UN, and this is what he had to say today.
And the joint investigation team uncover numerous violations and an abuse, including unlawful killings, extrajudicial execution, torture, sexual and gender-based violence, violation against refugee, and then forced displacement of civilians.
And another thing to add, Marco, is that this report was comprehensive, but it also had many limitations.
What kinds of limitations?
Well, this report won't actually lead to any criminal charges against the offenders. It's really up to the parties and those involved in the conflict to act on them. And also, investigators were limited in terms of where they could travel. Some of the areas, for example, Aksum, where there have been reports of massive human rights abuses, investigators weren't actually able to travel to. These days, each side will be quick to point out what the other side, when the other side commits crimes, but not hold their own people accountable. But investigators said today that they hope this report will encourage all parties to commit to a ceasefire to end the conflict and hopefully bring some accountability and justice for civilians.
Yes. So are these parties any closer to ending the conflict?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, 1 year on, things have only gotten worse. The conflict has expanded. Tigrayan forces say that they plan to march towards Addis Ababa, the capital, which is now, as of this week, under a state of national emergency. And Prime Minister Abiy has called on civilians to arm themselves. This week, the U.S. Embassy said U.S. citizens should seriously think about making plans to leave the country. U.S. Horn of Africa envoy Jeffrey Feltman said this earlier this week.
And the parties do not seem anywhere near to the point of agreeing to de-escalation, negotiated ceasefire, and some kind of talks.
As fighting continues, Marco, as it expands the horrible list of human rights violations that we heard a bit about already, ones that impact all Ethiopians across ethnicities, are just expected to continue piling up.
Troubling news on top of other troubling news. Halima Gikandi is the world's Africa correspondent based in Nairobi. Thank you very much, Halima.
Thank you, Marco.
As we just heard, Ethiopia's government has declared a state of emergency. We want to take a step back and look at how things reached this point. Alex Duvall is executive director of the World Peace Foundation and a professor at Tufts University. So, Alex, tomorrow is the anniversary of the start of this war. Explain what happened 1 year ago.
A year ago, political tensions between the regional government of Tigray and the federal government in Addis Ababa exploded into conflict. And there are conflicting versions of exactly how the war broke out. But there's no doubt that the federal government under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and his ally in next door Eritrea did have a military plan to topple the Tigrayan leadership. And so they launched a war. They called it a law enforcement operation, but it very quickly became clear that it was not just a war to achieve a political end, but also involved major large-scale abuses against the civilian population as well.
So what are those tensions really about?
The core issue here is whether Ethiopia should be ruled as a centralized, unitary political system, which is Prime Minister Abiy's view. He wants to revive what he considers the glory days of Ethiopia under monarchs and emperors of previous decades, or whether it should be a federal system, which is the Tigrayan view, in which major ethnic groups control their own regions and, in fact, have the right of self-determination.
And how far back do those tensions go between the region of Tigray and the government in Addis?
The tensions go back to a constitution that was adopted 30 years ago when the Tigrayans won a previous civil war and were in power. And many of the centralists, particularly from the Amhara ethnic group, thought this was a betrayal of Ethiopia's heritage.
So you mentioned Amhara. We hear about the Amhara. We hear about Tigrayans and another ethnic group, the Oromo. What role does ethnic division have in the Ethiopian conflict?
The Ethiopian constitution as it now exists can be described as an ethnic federal system. So each of the major ethnic groups in the country, including those three, Tigray, Amhara, and Oromo, each control their own regions. And this has a number of problems when you ethnicize conflict. But it was also introduced precisely in order to allow groups that had been historically marginalized and oppressed to express their cultural, linguistic, ethnic identity and rule themselves. And really the question as to whether Ethiopia is one nation or many nations is an underlying unresolved question.
So, Alex Duvall, what will it take to end this conflict? A complete reimagining of Ethiopia's federal system?
So I think what's needed is some sort of roundtable conference at which all the different groups come together and hammer out a new political settlement based roughly on the existing federal arrangement, but also examining its weaknesses and seeing how they can live together for the future.
How likely do you think that is?
At the moment, there's a great deal of hate speech emanating from Addis Ababa, from the government of Abiy, who does not want to concede that he is being defeated. And he's talking about vanquishing the Tigrayans with actively genocidal language. So an absolute precondition for any peaceable settlement is scaling back on this ethnic hatred and vitriol that is filling the public arena. And only then, I think, can Ethiopians begin to sit down and reconcile their differences.
Alex Duvall is executive director of the World Peace Foundation and a professor at Tufts University, catching us up on developments in Ethiopia, where the war in the region of Tigray is entering its second year. Alex, thank you very much for your insight.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to The World. You know what it means when you say, "I'm hanging in there." Turns out the feeling could be universal.
In China, you might say, "Guodichu, I'm getting by."
And in Israel?
So they'll say, "Iye besede," like, "it will be okay."
Or Iran?
Zendegi migzare, this too shall pass.
How we're all just hanging in there, still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Afghanistan has relied heavily on foreign aid for the past two decades. But since the Taliban took power in August, much of that aid has dried up. It's left many Afghans desperate for help. Astrid Sletten has spent much of the past few weeks crisscrossing Afghanistan, looking at the growing needs of people. She's the Afghanistan country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council and joins me from Kabul. So it sounds like you spent much of the past month in a 4x4 on some pretty rough roads in Afghanistan. Where were you able to get to, Astrid, and what was the journey like generally?
I can tell you the roads are horrible. What is striking is the drought. You can't see anything greenery anywhere. And you travel through these villages and you wonder, what do people eat? And then you see kids running around with skinny arms and leg and with that malnourished big belly. Previously, I've seen that in clinics. Now you see it everywhere. Another thing that was really an experience was going from Kandahar to Kabul by road. That has been a stretch that has been off limit for road travels for more than a decade due to insecurity. And you could really see the damages. I mean, whole villages were abandoned and you could see that their houses, their mud huts had been shot to pieces. All the bridges along the road, all the way from Kandahar, through Sabul, through Ghazni, through Wardak and into Kabul were destroyed, like blown to pieces. And we had to cross those bridges through dried rivers. So actually the only advantage of the drought right now is that you can cross rivers without being in need of a bridge.
The lack of greenery, what does that tell you just about how hungry Afghans are in the rural areas? I mean, what did you find out when you dug deeper?
I remember when we were passing one village and I saw some women and some children, they were sweeping with what looked like a broom. And I was asking my driver, what are they doing? And he said, well, they're picking up shreds from cactuses and they're using it as fodder for their animals. And the animals are so skinny. You look at them and you think, if you slaughter this thing, you will get skin and maybe bones for soup. You wonder, how are these animals alive? And there's very few animals.
Winter is on the way, along with freezing temperatures. Are Afghans ready?
No, Afghans are not ready. If you walk around in Kabul or any other big city, you will see people sitting surrounded with their meager belongings, trying to sell it so that they can buy something that can seal off their damaged houses. Because a lot of people have been forced to migrate into the big cities looking for any kind of income generating opportunities, being digging through garbage or begging.
What international aid is actually getting into the countryside right now, Astrid?
I'm really sorry to say this, hardly anything. One of the really happy moments I had when I left Baghdad was as we were driving out of the city area, when we were like coming more on the rural road, I saw a convoy of 8 WFP trucks. I have never been so happy to see WFP in action. But even WFP do not have the resources to provide food for the most needy people.
What is the Taliban saying or doing to provide some encouragement that they will deal with what could turn into a humanitarian disaster, the way you're describing it?
It's not it will turn into it. We are in the midst of a humanitarian disaster. We have tangible reports that children and elderly and the weakest are already dying from hypothermia and hunger. So we are in the middle of it. How bad it will be will still depend on the humanitarian donors.
Well, there is, as you well know, a lot of discussion about whether putting conditions on aid to Afghanistan makes sense. It's obviously important to get life-saving assistance to those who desperately need it. And at the same time, the international community doesn't want to aid and abet an extremist government. Is it possible to walk that line? Are you beginning to see what it's going to take?
The last thing Afghanistan needs is conditionality on life-saving humanitarian assistance. Yes, I do see the challenge of balancing this line, but there are ways of bypassing this. I do believe the UN is working hard on trying to set up a trust fund so that funding can be released from the Afghan reserves through the trust fund so that key public sector staff can be paid. Remember, healthcare workers and teachers, for example, in public sectors haven't been paid since April, and they're still coming to work. It is a disaster, and no NGO effort could replace an entire public sector in a country with close to 40 million people.
How hopeful are you then, Astrid, that the funds and resources will get to Afghanistan and will get to those who need them the most?
I live by the logic that everyone can help someone and no one can help everyone. And NRC and other NGOs, we're doing as best we can, but it is not going to be enough by a long shot. There are going to be mass exodus unless the donors ramp up massively their humanitarian funding to Afghanistan.
How concerned are you that the international community will not step up simply because no one really wants to prop up an unpopular government?
I think it is only a question of time before it becomes dangerous to be the receiver of aid and the giver of aid. Because if you come in with relief items and you do not have enough to the people who are in most need, then you will see riots, you will see looting, and it will be complete chaos. The numbers are so staggering. It's almost unthinkable that millions of people will die.
Is that essentially the statistic that you're working with looking into the future?
Joint assessments between NGOs and the UN have documented that the food insecurity in this country has gone from approximately 10 million to a staggering 20-something million. And these are estimates, and the reality is probably worse. I'm telling you that it's going to get really ugly.
Astrid Sletten is the Afghanistan country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She joined me from Kabul. Astrid, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's The View inside Afghanistan. Many thousands of people are still trying to flee the country beyond those who left at the end of the summer. Over the next 2 days on The World, we'll look at why the refugee resettlement process is bogged down, especially in the U.S. and Canada. Ai Weiwei is China's most famous contemporary artist and activist. He is unsparing in his criticism of the Chinese government. 10 years ago, Ai Weiwei spent 80 days in detention. When the Chinese government released him, he felt an urgency to write down his story. If he was detained again, he thought, he wanted his then 2-year-old son to know who he was. Another factor that led him to pen and paper, Ai Weiwei's own father.
I realize I know very little about my father.
His late father, Ai Qing, was a famous poet whose persecution during China's Cultural Revolution defined Ai Weiwei's upbringing.
So I think I need to do a lot of research to understand who he is. That's basically why I write this memoir.
Ai Weiwei's memoir has just been published. It's called 1,000 Years of Joys and Sorrows. Ai Weiwei spoke earlier this week with The World's Carol Hills.
Your father was quite a remarkable man. He was an intellectual who was both wooed by Mao Zedong in the 1940s and then spurned by him after the revolution. Why did Mao Zedong want his support?
So my father was already very well-known among the young progressive students or intellectuals. He created a new language which really relates to modernism. And his poetry is very, very emotional. He really used modern daily language to write poetry.
And Mao Zedong and the communists wanted his support because they wanted intellectuals to sign on with the communists?
Not only that, he is already very influential. And also a lot of people reading his poetry become revolutionary. So they think his writing will be very influential in terms of communist struggle.
You know, your father then threw his hat in with the communists somewhat reluctantly, but then fell out of favor after the revolution. The communists kind of turned on him and intellectuals and said all art and literature had to support the Communist Party. There's a really poignant image in your book when you describe you're 10 years old and you're helping your father burn his books. This was at the start of the Cultural Revolution. Do you remember what you felt at that time?
Well, young boy, of course, you felt your parents scared. That kind of feeling it's not only your family, it's the whole society so afraid of something happens to them. And my father decided to burn all his poetry books and art books because the Red Guard in Cultural Revolution, they always come to my home to search for some kind of anti-revolution traces. They would kick the door open and check on all the letters or books.
These were the Red Guards, the famous Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution?
Yes.
You were forced to live in cold and remote parts of China. For a period of time, you lived in a dugout with him, and food was scarce. I mean, the images that we learn about the Cultural Revolution are one you saw up close. Your father was forced to wear a dunce cap and parade around the village being jeered at. Did the experience of growing up as somebody whose father was being persecuted, did it make you in some ways feel comfortable with being an outsider?
You have no choice. It can be extremely harsh, but many people lost their lives during that period and that kind of struggle.
Did that experience, though, make you wary about ever being an insider?
Since I was born, my father was being criticized. So I always feel we are being singled out from the society as an anti-party or anti-people, you know. So, yeah, this is a given condition.
For much of your time as a critic and dissident when you were still in China, you've had ways to communicate with the outside. You've had Twitter, Facebook, email, the international media. Your father didn't have any of that. Does that make you think differently about how he handled his own persecution and the harsh experiences you went through as a kid?
Yes, that is a dramatic difference. Maybe because I realize my father is lacking any possibilities to express his true feelings, not even one sentence. So that pushed me into the internet because I really want to have clearly my voice to be heard. There's no such opportunity for any Chinese in past thousands of years. And I think I grabbed the opportunity and I did a lot on the internet.
You live in exile now. You have your self-expression back. But have you lost something in the trade-off?
I think yes. I don't have a so-called normal life or natural life now. I'm traveling. I'm always staying in hotels. Always have a sense of unfamiliarness with me. So, you know, you become a true foreigner or a true outsider.
Ai Weiwei, what would you like your father to understand about you?
It's my responsibility to be myself.
And do you think you're being yourself?
I'm trying.
Ai Weiwei, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was artist and activist Ai Weiwei speaking with my colleague Carol Hills about his new memoir, 1,000 Years of Joys and Sorrows. A COVID vaccine manufactured in India has been given emergency use approval by the World Health Organization. That means millions of Indians prevented from traveling abroad should soon be able to pack their suitcases. More importantly, the approval could also provide a huge boost to the global supply of COVID vaccines. Joining us is Prashant Yadav. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington. Prashant, tell us more about Covaxin. Why did the WHO give emergency use approval for this vaccine when so many others, like the Sputnik V vaccine from Russia and India's Novavax, they did not make it on this list?
So the others are still under evaluation, as far as I understand, by the WHO's evaluation team. But this comes from a company which has had many vaccines in the past that have been WHO pre-qualified, including for rotavirus, polio, and other. So there is a track record here of a company that has been developing and distributing vaccines globally with WHO approval in the past. Also, it is a vaccine which is an inactivated virus vaccine. So more manufacturers know how to make inactivated virus vaccines. There is more globally distributed know-how on how to make them. There is also more capacity in terms of plants around the world which can make an inactivated virus vaccine. But we have existing know-how and existing sites to make inactivated virus vaccines as compared to some of the novel platforms.
There are a handful of countries already using Covaxin. What happens now with WHO emergency approval? What difference will that make for those countries?
So the countries which are using Covaxin, that gives them greater confidence that their regulatory approval has also been vetted by the WHO's emergency use licensing process. And more importantly, it will bring additional countries which have so far not received Covaxin into the potential of using Covaxin. And this may also help the company and the Indian government think about a larger market for Covaxin and expand its manufacturing capacity. And if it means that this allows the Indian government to think there is sufficient manufacturing capacity, then there will be fewer or removal of export restrictions, which once again will open up more supplies coming to COVAX, the global initiative for vaccine sharing, and also for countries which want to buy directly from the two companies in India.
So India's Serum Institute was slated to be a major supplier of COVAX, the global initiative to supply low-income countries with vaccines for COVID, but that has fallen short. Will the WHO emergency approval of Covaxin help India follow through now on its obligations globally?
So if as a result of this approval, the government of India thinks there is a larger market for Covaxin, expands the manufacturing capacity of Covaxin in partnership with the company which has developed this, not only will there be supplies available of Covaxin to export to other countries and to the COVAX initiative, it may also open up the export of the product from the Serum Institute of India. So it may lead to a wider increase in supply.
And what about Indians who already have received the Covaxin dose? What does it mean for them?
So there are at least 100 million, if not more, Indians who've received Covaxin two doses. They are the ones who want to travel outside the country for trade, commerce, students who want to go outside to start or continue their education in foreign universities and have been stuck because they cannot travel. So this will allow them to resume their education, their economic activity, their trade and commerce, which will be beneficial not only for the millions of Indians who will be able to travel, but also for the businesses, places around the world where they provide services, IT, technology, software, university research, and so on.
That's Prashant Yadav. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, talking about the news today that the WHO has approved the Indian vaccine, Covaxin, for use against COVID-19. I was reading The Onion the other day, as one does, and I saw this headline, "Study confirms hanging in there, best one can now feel." Let me just read you the first part because it is an Onion classic. A study published Monday in the American Journal of Psychology determined that the maximum amount of happiness a human being can now experience falls within the range of getting by to hanging in there. I say hanging in there all the time, especially when asked, "How you doing?" during the pandemic. And then I started wondering, how do people in other parts of the globe express this state of being okay, but not great? We called up some of our world colleagues to find out.
All our expressions are one version or another of hang in there.
This is Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv, Israel.
So they'll say, "Yeah, besede," like, it will be okay. Things will be okay. But that's I mean, there's been a lot of criticism that that's the Israeli mindset. Then, it will be okay. We don't have to plan this military operation. It'll be okay. We don't need to plan this building properly. It'll be okay.
Yeah, said it.
So it means, you know, everything is in order, nothing out of the ordinary. You know, just let things flow as they may, and yeah, besedo.
In Mexico City, when someone asks Jorge Valencia how he's doing, he says,
Ahí, estoy ahí.
It literally means there, as in, I'm not doing great, not bad, I'm just, you know, there.
I saw a viral video, it was like a 5-second clip from an interview like 20 years ago with Gustavo Cerati, who's my favorite songwriter ever. And somebody asked the guy, like, "So how are you doing?" And the dude's like,
"Bastante mal."
Bad. Really bad. But what can you do? And I love that response. Because it's like, I think a lot of people wish that they could just answer that. But instead, my default is just like, "Ay, todo bien, ay."
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune.
So that's Mexico. Here's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai with the answer there to the question, how you doing?
In China, if you're just, you know, having a not-so-amazing day, you might say, 过得去, I'm getting by.
There's another phrase Rebecca prefers.
Mama hoo hoo, which actually means horse, horse, tiger, tiger. I have no idea where that comes from, because why would you say horse, horse, tiger, tiger? But I'm sure there's a good answer somewhere.
And that somewhere is YouTube. A quick sidebar here. Apparently, the saying comes from a story from the Song Dynasty.
相传南宋时期，京城有一位著名的画家。
The story goes, once upon a time, there was a painter. He was drawing a tiger when a man came up to him and asked him to paint a horse. The painter didn't want to start all over, so he just drew a horse's body and kept the head of the tiger. The customer asked, what's this? And he said, horse, horse, tiger, tiger. The customer walked away, so the man hung the painting in his own house. Then his son saw it and asked his dad what it was a painting of. The painter said, it's a horse. Later on, the kid sees what he thinks is a horse and tries to ride it. Turns out, it's a tiger, and the son gets eaten. And from that, we get the term horse, horse, tiger, tiger, meaning either someone who's incredibly careless or a situation that's neither horse nor tiger, something that's, you know, so-so. Here's one more from Rebecca in China.
True cool to eat bitterness. But I have not heard it used as in like, hey, how you doing? Or I'm eating bitterness. It's like it's a state of being. A whole concept of being able to take on pain and suffering without complaining. In Chinese culture and society, the ability to be like stoic and not complain is something to be admired. And parents, I think, would want to teach your kids to be able to 能吃苦, to be able to eat this bitterness.
Then there's the world's Shirin Jafari. She lives in Boston, but her family is back in Iran. Their response in pandemic times to, how you doing?
In my family, we would say, bad news, oza khube, migzare zendegi hamine, like that's life. It passes, like this too shall pass, something like this. And, you know, we try to like sort of be as upbeat as we can, even though it's very hard. I haven't seen my parents in more than 2 years now. So it's really, I just always constantly think about the moment that I'm going to be able to hug them again and hold them again.
I don't know when, but I do know that this too shall pass.
I think what's similar in every culture at this moment is that everybody is trying to get through. You know, that's the end goal. But sometimes Iranians try to be a little bit more poetic. So even in our version of I'm hanging in there in Farsi, Zendegi migzare, there's poetry in there. This too shall pass. This is life. This is part of our existence. We as humans have to get through this no matter how difficult it is.
Go somewhere I used to go. Well, it's a start, I suppose. This too shall pass.
Yeah, so true. I've got one more to send you on your way. When I sent a message to the folks here at The World asking for translations of I'm Hanging in There, Sylvia Maria Gross, one of our editors, just sent me a song from her native Brazil. In Portuguese, it means we carry on. Even when nothing changes, go the words. There is no other way, we carry on.
Mesmo com todavia, com todo dia, com todo ia, todo não ia.
And that's where we leave things today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Zendigi Migzera, Yehia Beseder, hang in there.
A gente vai levando essa guia.
mesmo com toda a fama,
com toda a brama,
com toda a cama,
com toda a lama. A gente vai levando, a gente vai levando, a gente vai levando, a gente vai levando essa guia.
From PRX.